Hello, and welcome to the In Conversation With podcast for the Lancet Respiratory Medicine. I'm Sophie Wolven, and today we'll be hearing from Professor Peter Openshaw and Dr. Felicity Liu from Imperial College London. They'll be discussing the use of inhaled corticosteroids in the treatment of COVID-19 and the involvement of the respiratory mucosa in response to viral infection. They'll also touch upon the latest findings of a recently published article that provides an update on the STOIC trial, looking into the inflammatory mechanisms behind budesonide treatment for early COVID-19.
So, Felicity, can you tell us about which treatments work at different stages of infection with SARS-CoV-2?
Yes, so we have a number of different strategies now for treating SARS-CoV-2, and in the very early stages of infection, antiviral therapies have been shown to be effective, in particular molnupiravir, which has been shown in phase 3 trials, if given early within the first 5 days of symptoms, to reduce your risk of hospitalisation. There are, of course, other agents which can be given intravenously, such as remdesivir, that have been shown to lower the risk in the outpatient setting. But, of course, that's a bit more challenging to give in the early phases of infection. And then we have options such as inhaled budesonide, which has been shown in the STOIC study that we're talking about today, to reduce your risk of hospitalisation, your relative risk of hospitalisation, by 91%. And then as you get into the later phases of infections, there have been studies looking at giving mixtures of antibody therapy to hospitalised patients, and that's been shown to be particularly effective in those who haven't mounted a very good antibody response of their own. And then finally, in the much later inflammatory phases of disease, we know that oral or intravenous steroids such as dexamethasone, which are given systemically, can improve survival, particularly if you're critically unwell, receiving oxygen or respiratory support. And then we have the cytokine inhibitors such as tocilizumab and baricitinib, which have been shown to be effective if you have evidence of systemic inflammation. So we've got lots of options now to treat different stages of COVID-19.
I think it's been quite extraordinary, really, to see so much research done so fast in such a definitive manner. I don't think we've ever seen that before with any other disease being done so quickly. And to be able to actually define an exact moment at which to use all of these different therapies is unprecedented. And I hope there'll be a way forward in future. You know, I think you could sort of sum this up and say, you know, cometh the hour, cometh the drug, almost. So that, you know, a drug which is beneficial at one phase may actually be harmful at another or useless. And that's really, really important.
So, Peter, in our comment, we discuss the immunological tone of the respiratory mucosa and how important it is in determining our response to a respiratory viral infection. Could you tell us a bit more about this and how this fits in with COVID-19?
Well, we've been interested in the state of the respiratory mucosa and its importance in whether you're receptive to a virus or not for a long time. And I think what's become clear is that it's almost like a muscle, that if you use it, then it develops more power, more strength. Some people have compared the memory that there is in T cells and B cells to the sort of neural memory, the ordinary memory that you have in your brain, whereas the memory you have in your mucosa is more like, you know, a muscle that you build. And in the studies that we did with RSV challenge some time back now, we showed that the status of the mucosa was a key determinant in whether RSV was taken or not after it was inoculated intranasally. So we called that the sort of immunological tone of the mucosa. And if we think about this in relation to the figure, you know, a virus goes into the nose and there's a choice to be made. Either the infection takes or it's rejected. And this is, to a large extent, determined by whether the mucosa is in a receptive state or a state of partial activation, in which case it may well reject the virus before it ever gets to the stage of causing a response or of creating the inflammatory cytokines, which are a feature of early disease. So Felicity, there's been multiple studies looking into the various chronic respiratory diseases and how people with these diseases might be at increased risk of severe COVID, and how the use of inhaled steroids, corticosteroids, might affect the increased risk. Can you talk us through what we know so far about the use of inhaled corticosteroids and their effect on COVID-19?
Yes, so it's very interesting, and it's quite a complex picture, picking out what's related to the underlying respiratory disease and what's related to the effects of treatments of the disease, such as inhaled corticosteroids. So there's some quite strong data out there by the ISRIC 4C study, which suggests that patients who have pulmonary fibrosis are, regardless of confounders, extremely high risk for needing intubation or death after hospitalisation with COVID-19. But the picture in asthma and COPD is a bit more complicated. And we have the Open Safely study, which was of 24 million UK patients, that suggested that asthma wasn't a particularly strong risk factor for severe COVID-19. And that if you did have asthma and used corticosteroid inhalers, you were actually more likely to have a bad outcome with COVID-19. And that might be relating to the fact that that's confounded by those who use steroids as having slightly worse lung disease at baseline. And then interestingly, we have another study, again by the ISRIC 4C consortium, which showed that if you are older than 50 years and had asthma, using steroids could improve your survival, though that wasn't necessarily true if you were under 50 years with asthma or for of any age with COPD. So the picture certainly isn't clear at all, and it's being helped by clinical trials such as the STOIC study, which has shown that steroid use does reduce the risk of hospitalisation with COVID-19. But there have been other phase 3 studies, such as the PRINCIPLE study, which looked specifically at older patients who were older than 65 or older than 50 with comorbidities, and found that although steroids reduced the time for recovery after COVID-19, it didn't necessarily prevent hospitalisation or death. So the picture's far from clear, and it's certainly an area that needs a bit more research.
So, I mean, it is really complicated, isn't it? Again, I remember this vividly back in the days of the 2009 flu pandemic, when we were trying to sort out why it was that asthma did seem to put you at greater risk of hospitalisation. And we thought initially that that would be because, a virus infection makes you more wheezy, it precipitates an exacerbation. But the study that Aki Jha did, who's a chest physician now working in Cambridge, showed that it wasn't that really. It was just that for some reason people with asthma were more prone to end up in hospital. But actually, the time that they stayed in hospital was half as long as people without asthma. So they seemed to come in early and to have short, sharp admissions, possibly, we thought, because they already had some pre-existing inflammation in their respiratory tract due to the asthma, and that caused an increase in the severity of the flu-like symptoms, but those resolve very quickly. So it's a very complicated picture, isn't it? And I think that complicated picture that we saw in the MOSAIC study back in 2009 has really been sort of repeated almost in COVID-19. So Felicity, tell us about why the results of the original STOIC trial are important in the context of treating COVID-19 early on, and how do these results fit with that wider evidence on other COVID-19 treatments?
So, as we've already discussed, we do have lots of options in our armoury against COVID-19, but a lot of the treatments that came out, particularly in the earlier wave of the pandemic, was targeting the late inflammatory phase. And by this point, patients are already very sick, they're already hospitalised, and really what we'd like would be to have a better preventative strategy, outside of vaccination, of course. And the exciting thing about inhaled budesonide or inhaled corticosteroids is that we already know that they're safe, as they're already in wide use by lots of patients with asthma or other chronic respiratory illnesses. They're relatively cheap. And so if we were able to repurpose these treatments to give in early COVID-19 and reduce the risk of severe disease even shortly after exposure to the virus, when you're an outpatient, that could have huge socioeconomic benefits in terms of reducing the need for hospital admission and attendance to GPs and A&Es. And in contrast, when we think about some of the other medicines that we talked about earlier, particularly the antiviral agents, they're a bit more challenging, although they have been shown to be effective because they are very expensive, or in the case of remdesivir, they need to be given intravenously.
So Felicity, do you think that the STOIC trial has really delivered a definitive result here, or do we need more studies? Do we need more research?
Yeah, so I think we do need a bit more research, particularly given that the results of the STOIC study haven't been replicated in other clinical trials, such as the PRINCIPLE study. And given the complicated picture that we've just discussed, it may well be that patient selection is really key, and your underlying comorbidities or age may really influence how effective inhaled budesonide is for you.
So it's a really intriguing finding, but you know, as usual, more research is needed. That's great.
Yeah. So, Peter, in our comment piece, we discussed the current study by Baker and colleagues. Could you just tell us a bit more about how you think it enhances our understanding of early disease in COVID-19, and also how inhaled budesonide might work to reduce the risk of clinical deterioration?
So what Baker did, which was a very, very important step, is they took some local secretions from the nose and they analysed the cytokines and chemokines that were present there. And, I think that is really the way forward, is to make sure that you're focusing on the actual nasal mucosa. And what they found was that response that was seen in the nasal mucosa did seem to determine disease outcome, and really gave a mechanism whereby these inhaled steroids might work. So in particular, they showed that in 11 of their participants who deteriorated, there was a blunted antiviral response, indicating that this might be why they did so badly. Do you want to add a bit to that, Christy?
So I just wanted to say that I think it is very interesting that they show, although it isn't a fairly small number of participants that deteriorated, that there is a potential mechanism there for why people get so unwell. And I think that's really supported by the fact that antiviral agents in that early stage are so effective. But of course, I think this is something that needs to be looked into further, where we have larger numbers of people deteriorating compared to those who don't, to really distill down what the mechanisms are driving this. And then I suppose my next question for you should be, what do you think we should do next to explore this relationship and understand how mucosal events might influence disease outcome?
Well, the thing which really I'm left feeling very puzzled about is that the steroids that they were delivering were delivered via an inhaler taking the steroid down into the lung, whereas the responses that they were looking at were in the nose. So normally these inhalations don't go through the nose, they go through the mouth. The nose isn't part of the respiratory tract, which is covered in the inhaled corticosteroid. So, you know, how is that connection made? Is it that there is actually some crosstalk between the mucosa in the lung and in the nose? There's been quite a literature on that over many years. It would be convenient if there is good crosstalk, because it means that we could just measure what happens in the nose and thereby infer what's going on in the lung. But I think that isn't by any means determined to be a secure fact. So, you know, how is it that inhaling this steroid has this effect on the nose? I suppose you could say that it's having its effect via the bloodstream, but I don't think we quite know. There's quite a bit we still don't really understand in terms of how this treatment might be beneficial.
Yes, so I completely agree. And I suppose in the future, although it can be very challenging in clinical studies, thinking about sampling and examining the lower respiratory tract is really a priority.
Thank you both for your thoughts on this interesting topic, and thanks everyone for listening. Remember, you can access the paper we've discussed today, along with the linked comment from Peter and Felicity at thelancet.com. You can find this episode with our other podcasts wherever you usually get your podcasts.